from ABC News, World News This Week. I'm John Belmont, ABC News. Listen.
While the president is not prepared to repeat his previous offer rejected by Saddam Hussein, he is ready to make one last attempt to go the extra mile for peace.
Iraqi television broadcast a statement from Iraq's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, who said he would travel to Geneva next Wednesday to meet U.S. Secretary of State James Baker.
Now I'm stuck. I'm really stuck. I mean, I need food in my house, you know. What am I going to do?
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's world news.
Lethal is one way to describe him. Fearless is another. But that's his nature. He's not one to back down. One look, and you know he deserves respect. Plenty of it. You can sense the danger. You can see it in his eyes. That is, if you can see him at all, because he's a master at the art of camouflage. He's a Marine. And he's one of a kind, a very special breed of man who's part of an elite and proud corps few can join, very few. But if you think you'd like to give it a try, call 1-800-MARINES, because maybe, just maybe, you'll succeed. And if you do, you'll be ready for anything or anyone that comes your way. The Marines, we're looking for a few good men.
These Marines on the front lines in Saudi Arabia did what much of the world did last Monday midnight, observe the passing of the old year into the new. And as in so many years before, the hope of the world is for peace. And as in so many years before, peace is threatened. The hope for 1991 is that there will be no fighting in the Persian Gulf because of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And the U.S. troops there got a visit from Vice President Dan Quayle to reassure them.
You, my friends, are not alone. The hopes and the prayers of the American people are with you, and they support you every single step of the way.
Men like Bernard Satterwhite are not spoiling for a fight, but the waiting is killing them.
War is inevitable. I just soon, like everybody else, I think, in this region, is get it over with, get it started, get it over with, and move along.
Secretary of State Baker has also been counting the days until the U.N. deadline for Iraq to get out expires.
As January 15 approaches, we are closer and closer to restoring Kuwait's sovereignty, whether by peace or whether by force. But Kuwait's sovereignty is going to be restored.
Along with the tough words, room for diplomatic maneuvering, announced at the White House by spokesman Marlon Fitzwater.
While the president is not prepared to repeat his previous offer rejected by Saddam Hussein, he is ready to make one last attempt to go the extra mile for peace. The president has therefore offered, through our charge, Joe Wilson in Baghdad, to have Secretary Baker meet with Iraqi Foreign Minister Aziz in Switzerland during the period January 7 through 9.
Iraq mulled over Thursday's offer. Then, as we heard from ABC's Susan Hack in Amman, Jordan,
Iraqi television broadcast a statement from Iraq's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, who said he would travel to Geneva next Wednesday to meet U.S. Secretary of State James Baker. The broadcast, monitored here in Amman, said Iraq had agreed to the meeting not out of pressure, but out of a desire for peace and for a fair settlement for the region. Aziz said the U.S. had shown arrogance in trying to set preconditions for the talks, but he also insisted that the first topic for discussion would not be Kuwait, but the Palestinian question.
Asked if Secretary Baker would consider that at next Wednesday's talks, President Bush told reporters,
"He and I are in total sync on this, and so are the rest of the alliance. There will be no linkage on these two questions."
In fact, as White House spokesman Fitzwater put it,
"This offer is being made subject to the same conditions as the president's previous attempt. No negotiations, no compromises, no attempts at face-saving, and no rewards for aggression."
At the same time, the 12-nation European community has promised Baghdad that it would work to resolve all problems in the Middle East, including the Palestinian question, if the Gulf crisis could be settled peacefully. President Bush and the Secretary General of the United Nations discussed the entire situation at week's end, and according to ABC's Kyle Gibson,
the three-hour meeting between Perez de Cuellar and President Bush does not seem to have produced any new initiatives. After Perez de Cuellar departed Camp David, the White House released a statement saying the two expressed their determination to achieve fully the objectives outlined in the UN resolutions. Later, when Perez de Cuellar was asked whether he would be traveling to Baghdad, he said he had no plans to do so. He added he would wait to hear the outcome of the Wednesday meeting between Secretary of State Baker and Iraq's Tariq Aziz before considering any other action.
The uncertainty of the current situation has caused a couple of airlines to suspend their service to the Middle East. Pan Am's Pamela Hanlon says it's because of skyrocketing insurance rates for landings.
The rates increased in the case of the flights to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, tenfold to $162,000 a flight. In the case of Israel, the rates increased to $65,000 per flight, which is actually a 20-fold increase.
Pan Am says it's working with the government to resolve the matter, since Washington can provide insurance coverage for commercial aircraft in situations like this one. Along with the uneasiness of the January 15th deadline and the diplomatic maneuvering has come a new element through the air. A new station calling itself Radio Free Iraq has started beaming anti-Saddam broadcasts to its Arab audience. ABC's Norman Batorf has been listening.
Broadcasting on at least three shortwave frequencies, heard clearly here in Baghdad, Radio Free Iraq says its purpose is to provide the truth about Iraq to the Arab world. In commentaries interspersed with Western and Arabic music, the radio calls for the withdrawal of Iraqi forces from Kuwait and says Saddam Hussein's government is spreading misinformation. Radio Free Iraq did not identify the source of its transmission, but the signal is thought to originate in a neighboring Middle Eastern nation.
The Soviet Union has supported the U.S. in its Gulf policy, and during the exchange of messages between Washington and Moscow on New Year's Day, President Bush praised his counterpart for that and went on to say,
on this New Year's Day, as you celebrate with your friends and family, I also want to applaud the Soviet Union for the important steps you've taken in building a new society, for the determination with which you are pressing forward with difficult political and economic reforms.
Through his translator, President Gorbachev acknowledged his difficulties and his hopes for the future.
Today, no one has a carefree life. So, with my greetings and congratulations to the Americans on this new year, I wish you success in all you do, well-being to your families, and peace to your great country.
In this country, the new year brings with it the reorganization of government at various levels. On Capitol Hill, the 102nd Congress was gaveled to order, and House Speaker Tom Foley administered the oath of office to the new members.
Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic?
ABC's Vic Ratner says it may be a new Congress, but it's still politics as usual.
It didn't take long for the friendly goodwill of the new Congress to turn partisan. The House had been in session less than 2 hours when Democrats and Republicans squared off in an often angry fight over how to deal with the deficit and spending figures. Democrats also unveiled part of their domestic agenda, including a promised anti-recession package and a family leave measure that the White House opposes. Democratic leaders also gave a new civil rights bill top priority this year by making it H.R. number one, the designation for the first bill in the new Congress.
The Persian Gulf was also high on the minds of the lawmakers, with the head of the General Accounting Office, Charles Boucher, telling a House committee that the cost of war would be staggering, not only in terms of lives lost.
Should there be armed conflict, others have estimated that the expenditures could total hundreds of millions of dollars more per day, particularly in the early days of the conflict. I think one of your later witnesses today will say it might be as high as $2 billion per day in those early days of the conflict.
On the Senate side, the talk centered on administration policy, with Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy releasing a letter from 127 law professors, backing up the tradition of advise and consent.
These scholars represent a broad philosophical spectrum. Their views confirm unequivocally that the Constitution bars President Bush from launching offensive military action in the Persian Gulf without the prior approval of Congress.
There was also a move to begin floor debate on the issue, with Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin saying,
"Now is the time and here is the place to debate the constitutional prerogatives of the President of the United States. Not on January the 23rd, but now, before January the 15th.
Disagreement from Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell.
"It may be the place, I don't believe it's the time."
Mitchell and others think the upcoming Baker-Aziz talks should be given a chance first. Little has been heard lately from Central America, although the fighting between the U.S.-supported government and communist rebels in El Salvador has continued. The fighting struck home this past week when three American crew members of a U.S. Army helicopter were killed in El Salvador. The rebel group known as the FMLN claims responsibility and says the men died when the chopper crashed. But at the Pentagon, spokesman Pete Williams says there are some unanswered questions.
"There are serious inconsistencies in their story. They say that they shot the helicopter down. However, there is evidence, which we are pursuing, that the helicopter landed in a controlled fashion. All three U.S. servicemen have gunshot wounds to the head, and two of these have no other apparent wounds."
Williams says that could indicate the soldiers were executed and that a forensic team will determine exactly how they died. In the capital city of San Salvador, ABC News producer Bert Pakas says,
"It wouldn't make any sense for the guerrillas to have executed the American soldiers. It would have made more sense for them to have captured them as POWs and kept them as bargaining chips for the future. And it would have been a big propaganda victory for the guerrillas to have captured the soldiers."
But on the floor of the House, Pennsylvania Republican Bud Schuster says the men were murdered.
"This atrocity will give second thoughts to those Americans who are giving aid and comfort and financial support to the FMLN communist guerrillas in El Salvador. It's my hope that more Americans will begin to see these FMLN communist guerrillas for the brutal killers that they are."
The incident could give the administration something it's been looking for, a reason to send the Salvadoran government another $40 million in military aid. The Federal Reserve has been trying to aid the economy by relaxing its interest rates. And this past week, several large banks followed the lead by dropping their prime interest rate from 10 to 9.5%. The move should mean lower consumer rates in the weeks ahead. In Rhode Island, consumers got a rude shock just a couple of hours after the state's new governor, Bruce Sundland, was inaugurated.
"I am declaring a bank emergency in Rhode Island."
In Providence, ABC's Chris Camp explains the whys and wherefores.
"The action comes in the wake of the collapse of the Heritage Loan and Investment Company, whose president is charged with embezzling millions and who disappeared nearly 2 months ago. The problem lies with the private insurance group, which, in order to cover the Heritage losses, now finds itself unable to adequately cover its remaining institutions and the $1.7 billion on deposit."
About half of Rhode Island's banks, investment companies, and credit unions were forced to shut down, leaving depositors such as this woman with no way to retrieve their money.
"Now I'm stuck. I'm really stuck. I mean, I need food in my house, you know. What am I going to do?"
Governor Sundland came to the rescue, though, pledging to ensure that all depositors would get most of their money, even if the state treasury has to put up the cash.
"Liquidation in payment to depositors of the full value of their deposits in cash or scrip in the shortest possible time."
As the problem in Rhode Island was surfacing, the Bank of New England, the most troubled of the nation's large banking companies, announced that huge losses expected for the fourth quarter would leave it with no money to absorb future losses from bad loans. The administration has been reluctant to use the word recession when describing the state of the economy, but in an interview with David Frost on PBS, President Bush finally did.
"We're in a slowdown economically in this country, if not recession. In some areas, we're clearly in recession. And this concerns me because people are hurting."
Hurting very badly when it comes to jobs. December's unemployment rate jumped to 6.1%, highest level in more than 3 years. New York State Labor Commissioner Tom Hartnett says several major groups of workers are especially hard hit.
"Manufacturing is an area where people are losing their jobs, the financial and service industry. Post-holidays now, you'll see a fall off in retail also. General service sector, you still see some growth, and in the hospital and healthcare industry. There is still kind of holding its own.
Hardin mentioned the retail industry, one which has seen its sales plummet recently.
Looks like the Grinch stole Christmas for retailers in 1990. I think the culprit was consumer confidence.
And that, says retail consultant William Flatley, is borne out at the country's biggest retailer, Sears, where 21,000 pink slips are being handed out with the start of the new year. Despite last month's high jobless rate, the increase was less than expected. That gives some credence to what President Bush says about the current recession.
I happen to believe, and I think most economists believe, that the recession will be mild, and that the whole country will come out of it in not too many months from now.
So the president says he has no plans to jumpstart the economy with new federal spending. The new year has brought with it higher Social Security benefits, 5.4% more for recipients. And Social Security Commissioner Gwendolyn King tells us how that increase will be covered.
The good news is the tax has not increased. The bad news, however, is that the base on which we pay that tax is going to be broadened just a little bit. Last year, we paid Social Security taxes on the first $51,300. This year, we'll pay the same 6.2% tax on the first $53,400.
And it looks as though the Postal Service will get to raise the price of a first-class letter, but by not quite as much as it requested.
A 29 cent basic letter stamp in place of the 30 cent rate, as well as a 19 cent postcard rate instead of the 20 cent rate.
That's the head of the Postal Rate Commission, George Haley, who says the new rates are expected to go into effect on February 3rd. Continental Can has come to terms with more than 3,000 employees who said they had been targeted for layoffs so that the company wouldn't have to pay them pension benefits. Leon Lynch of the Steelworkers Union explains how Continental Can did it.
The company's illegal and immoral scheme used a sophisticated computer program to target workers for layoff to prevent them from reaching the 20-year mark. In many cases, workers needed only weeks or months to reach 20 years.
The settlement will cost Continental Can $415 million. Strict new firearm regulations took effect in California on New Year's Day. The laws banned the sale of 56 types of semi-automatic weapons and put into effect a 15-day waiting period for the purchase of rifles and shotguns. Previously, that provision had applied only to handguns. On Capitol Hill, former White House News Secretary Jim Brady is again trying to push a gun control law through Congress.
In just 3 months, I will observe an anniversary that I'm not looking forward to, the 10th anniversary of the assassination attempt on my former boss, President Reagan, that put me in this wheelchair. It's not a day I like to think about, but I must. And I realize I was fortunate somehow to being survived shot in the head. Many other gunshot victims are not so fortunate.
Chief opposition for the so-called Brady Bill is the National Rifle Association. The weather has brought good and bad news for the country this first week of 1991. In the Northeast, where fuel oil consumption is traditionally high, temperatures have been higher than normal. So,
Overall heating oil demand so far this winter has been unusually low across the Northeast. And it looks like that'll be the same general trend here as we go into the early portion of January.
But, says private meteorologist John Davis, the West has been unusually cold, and that trend is likely to continue.
It's kind of like the atmosphere is going to reload its gun of Arctic air. And I think by the middle to end of January, we are going to see more surges of cold air move down into the western portion of the country.
That cold has already caused major problems for California's citrus industry. Leon Kraft is the agriculture commissioner for Tulare County in the central part of the state.
We have about 25% of the navel orange crop harvested, and everything else was still on the trees. And what was on the trees is, my guess is, around 90% lost.
California's also been bone dry for as long as 4 years in some places. And while the state has received some rain recently, ABC's Jane Platt tells us,
California is still several inches shy of the rainfall level that's normal for this time of year. So unless the area gets several more rainstorms, water rationing will continue in many cities. Dry brush may spark devastating fires, and crops will suffer further damage.
Florida also has a drought problem, and there's a possibility that restrictions on the use of water will be expanded. In the Midwest, it's a case of too much water.
I really haven't seen it this bad for years and years. In my memory, I have not seen it this bad.
That's the mayor of Kokomo, Indiana, Robert Sargent, where the floods are the worst since 1913. President Bush has declared six Indiana counties disaster areas. Parts of Ohio, Kentucky, and Illinois also had problems with high water. Among the obituaries of the past week, that of Keel Martin. Fans of TV's Hill Street Blues will remember him as the Wheeler Dealer detective, J.D. LaRue. Keel Martin died of complications from lung cancer. He was 46. There were two deaths of note in the world of sport. George Allen died New Year's Eve. Allen was the coach at Long Beach State, but he's best remembered for his years as head coach of the Los Angeles Rams and the Washington Redskins, where he was the winningest coach for each team. George Allen was 72 when he died of heart problems. And Luke Appling is dead. He was the shortstop for the Chicago White Sox during the 1930s and 40s, and one of the team's best hitters. Appling made the Hall of Fame, but he was perhaps best known for his uncanny ability to foul off 3-2 pitches, and for his ailments, real and imaginary, which earned him the nickname Old Aches and Pains. Luke Appling was 83. The story of a long-time mystery. When World News This Week continues in a moment.
Howdy, this is Steve Allen. I'd like to tell you about an organization of kids in the United States who are making this world a better place for all of us to live in. The members of HCA, and they call themselves Young Catholics in Mission. Through HCA programs, elementary school kids are doing some pretty amazing things. They're getting to know their world neighbors. They learn about the languages they speak, the food they eat, the games they play. And in learning, our kids often come across some harsh realities, that many of their peers lack adequate nutrition and food. Many live in war-torn situations. Most go to bed hungry. Each year, kids here make donations and raise funds to help their less fortunate third world neighbors. HCA kids are doing a great job, but they can't do it alone. If you'd like to learn more about this group of children helping children, write to HCA, that's the Holy Childhood Association, P.O. Box 18792, Washington, D.C., 20036.
The mystery of what happened to Amelia Earhart has intrigued us for years. In 1937, the world-renowned aviatrix and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared while trying to complete an around-the-world flight. They were trying to reach Howland Island in the Pacific at the time. Well, now something's been found on another island some 600 miles north of American Samoa, and it intrigues the head of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, Richard Gillespie.
We found in the debris of an abandoned native village an artifact, a box about the size of the proverbial bread box, a little over a foot tall, about 10 inches wide, made of aluminum, that exhibited characteristics in rivet patterns and stiffeners and so forth that was reminiscent of aircraft parts.
Gillespie is not prepared to say the item is from Amelia Earhart's plane, but he and his research team will be going back to the area where it was found. They'll search the deep waters surrounding the island in hopes of clearing up the 53-year-old mystery of Amelia Earhart's disappearance. And those are the people and stories that made world news this week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longin. Engineering by Tien Truong. I'm John Belmont, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.